Welcome to Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with us today is Heather Amy O'Neill, author of The Irish Goodbye. Now, Heather is a poet, a teacher, and the assistant director of the Sackett Street Writers Workshop. She lives in Brooklyn with her wife and two sons, and The Irish Goodbye is her first novel. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Heather.
Thanks for having me.
Now, do you use your middle name? Like, should I say Heather Amy, or should I?
No, you can just, Heather is great.
Okay, all right. So, I understand you've been working on this book for a while.
I would say about, I would say altogether it was about 4 or 5 years.
End, which not that long.
That's pretty standard.
Yeah, that's pretty normal. Standard. That's pretty normal. Yeah. But you've been working with writers for over 20 years. So does it feel now to have your debut novel being published after helping so many others with theirs?
It feels a bit surreal to be on the other side of it, I will say, but super exciting. My publishing background is in poetry, and poetry is just a completely different beast when it comes to the publishing process and journey. So the work that I've done with writers as a teacher and as a coach and as an editor, it's all about the writing process and the editing process. And I, once they were done with that, they would go off into the world and hopefully get the work published and, able to share it. But then they were on kind of a separate part of their own journey. And so when I began my journey with trying to publish this novel, it was kind of new to me. And I learned a ton, and actually I've had a really good experience. I know that that's not always the case, but I'm fortunate. So.
Well, let's back up a little bit and talk about the work that you have done as a coach and a teacher. So you taught at Hunter College, mm-hmm. and were you teaching poetry? Were you teaching creative writing?
Yeah, I was teaching everything. All kinds of writing, poetry, fiction, essay writing. I also taught a literature class, a queer literature class, which was really lovely. When I went to graduate school, I actually went to graduate school for fiction, not for poetry, because I knew I wanted to write fiction. I knew I wanted to write a novel. I had one or many in me. And when I graduated, I fell into teaching, and that I come from a family of teachers, and I never thought that that would be anything I would do. And I completely fell in love with it. I just totally fell in love with it. So that continued to be my career for many years. And I've said this before, and I mean this quite literally, that teaching taught me how to be a writer. I went to graduate school, and I have worked with phenomenal teachers who have taught me so much, but the experience of day in and day out working with other writers on their stories, it's that kind of, it's that idea of 10,000 hours plus, you devote that to a craft, and you tend to pick something up. So it was really that engagement and that experience with working with other writers that gave me that opportunity. I'm so grateful for it.
So when you, were you writing fiction all along too, or did you sort of put that aside while you were focusing on teaching and poetry?
No, I was always doing a kind of a balancing act of teaching, writing, and taking care of my family. That was, that was kind of the triangle of my life. And with writing, after graduate school, I did publish two collections of poetry, and that was really fulfilling and wonderful. But I was working on novels. I did write a novel when I was in graduate school, and my mentor there, shared it with his agent, and he was very very supportive of me and of the book, but his agent pointed out that there really wasn't much of a plot to the novel, and she was right. And I, you know, at the time, I didn't think she was right, and I didn't understand it. But I actually didn't really pursue sharing it with other agents, and I think that there was maybe a part of me that knew that that was true, or I don't know, you know, maybe it was just insecurity. But I put that novel in a drawer, and then, as you know, as I mentioned, I got you know, slowly got more and more into independent editing, and had some clients that went on to do quite well, and that became really my full-time, mostly my, you know, I left teaching Hunter to pursue editing full-time. And it was in that journey that I began to understand, oh yeah, plot really does matter when it's not there. The story is not as interesting. But it was a good experience, because I, you know, when I'm talking to a writer and I'm explaining to them what's, you know, potentially not working about a piece or what could be strengthened, I understand what it feels like to not really fully get it, you know, when somebody's trying to share that with you. And so even just the exercise of understanding what is the best way that I can communicate this, that I can articulate, you know, what's not working or what is working, helped me in my own writing. And so when I began to work on this book, you know, I could take a lot of those lessons and apply them.
So what is the Sackett Street Writers Workshop?
The Sackett Street Writers Workshop is a writing community that was started by Julia Fierro, who's a writer and teacher and just wonderful person. And we hire teachers to teach small workshops, writers to teach small workshops, oftentimes in their homes, sometimes in a rented space, sometimes virtually. And it's a collection of anywhere from, you know, 6 to maybe a top 10 writers who come together to share their work. And the writer who's teaching facilitates the conversation and helps with the workshop process. And it's based on the Iowa method of workshopping. And it's a really fabulous community. It's been the home to many extraordinary writers, teachers, students who've gone on to, you know, just exceed all expectations. So it's I would say it's a writing community. There's not like a single home base. Most of the classes are taught out of New York. But again, because it's virtual, I mean, I've taught classes with people in Siberia.
Wow.
You know,
was University of Iowa Writers Workshop where you did your graduate program?
No. Isn't, but it's where Julia did, and so she's applied that program to this. So when she started Sackett Street, she, you know.
Okay. So how did you said you left teaching and to focus on independent editing, but I'm curious as to how you found clients and how that kind of how the business model of being an independent editor works.
Yeah. So I left Hunter, but I was still teaching at Sackett Street. I've been teaching at Sackett Street for, oh gosh, I think 17 years. And so a lot of the writers that I would work with at Sackett Street after we would finish a class or a workshop, they would need help on a developmental edit, say, for example, of their entire manuscript. And so they would hire me as a developmental editor. And instead of reading their work in the class, I would read their work separately and read the entire manuscript rather than an excerpt of it that was being discussed in the class, and give them feedback and help them then, you know, potentially apply that feedback to a revision. So I began doing that more and more. And then it was really word of mouth. And I was able to, you know, I just had a nice stream of clients coming in. I think that in this industry, word of mouth, you know, really does help, because there's a lot of writers looking for that kind of feedback. I have worked with independent editors, and it's been invaluable to me, and in terms of my own process. So, you know, I think that there's a myth that writing is, you know, it's just a go it alone, you know, kind of lonely, solitary experience. And there is a lot of solitary time, obviously, that's spent writing. I happen to enjoy that time, so it's not hard for me, but it's not easy for every writer. But even with that, I think it's extremely helpful to have a community or person or people to share the work with and to get honest feedback, you know, objective feedback. Right. I don't necessarily recommend you look for that in your family or your spouse, but I know people who do, and, yes, and it yes. works great. So, and, you know, but you know, so someone that can like really that who you can hear the feedback from,
right?
You
know? Because and sometimes when it's someone that you're close to, it's hard to hear that. It's hard for them to give anything that's not positive, and it's hard for you to hear anything that's not positive from them.
It's true.
Yeah. Now, it's what true. Exactly is a developmental edit?
So developmental edit, and I really do all kinds of editing, but a developmental edit is when a developmental editor reads your manuscript and from a holistic perspective gives you feedback on what's working and what you might want to revise. So instead of, you know, it's not a line edit where they're editing every line and shaping the sentence. It's more looking at big picture stuff. Is the plot working? Are the characters fully drawn? Is the world, you know, are you establishing the world and so the reader can see it and experience it? Is there a plot? You know, so kind of answering some of the bigger questions. And once you get that feedback, you can, if you agree with it, and you know, work with the developmental editor on a strategy on how to, for example, if there's not a plot or if the characters don't feel kind of fully alive on the page, what are some ways that that you can resolve that in the revision process?
Are there certain genres that you do or don't do?
I work. In, you know, I work on memoir and on fiction and in fiction. I would not say that anyone should hire me for science fiction or probably fantasy. I have worked on projects like that, but I've been upfront with the writer. You know, this is not my background. I don't know a lot about the particular genre. You know, different genres have formulas and those formulas are really important to adhere to. So the writers I've worked with in those genres, they know the formula really well. And I try to do some like catch up, you know, like, okay, what is the exact, you know, like arc here? But I sometimes joke that, you know, my brother-in-law loves Star Wars and if somebody brought me the script of Star Wars, I would say like, this is kind of confusing to me. my sons are obsessed with Marvel movies and I love watching them, but I understand, I mean, maybe 20%. And when we leave the theater, they're talking in detail about certain, you know, parts of the story and I'm still feel like I'm catching up with it. So I don't think that would be my strength.
Right, right. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Heather Amy O'Neill, author of The Irish Goodbye. So tell us what this book is about and what the title means.
Sure. The book is the story of three sisters who are returning home for Thanksgiving on the North Shore of Long Island. And when the oldest sister invites a guest from their past, the family's forced to confront a tragedy that has haunted them for years. And the title comes from, I don't know if your listeners, I'm sure plenty of them do know what an Irish goodbye is, but for those who don't, an Irish goodbye is essentially when you leave without announcing your departure. You know, so you leave without saying goodbye. And I come from an Irish family, a very, very big family, and I like to joke that in my family, if you don't know how to do an Irish goodbye, you're never going to get out. Because you know, parties are like can be 100 people, so you have to figure out how to do that. But the title comes from a scene in the book where the youngest sister, the novel is told from three points of view, from all the sisters' points of view. And it's a scene somewhat towards the end where the youngest sister, Maggie, is talking to her nephew. And he's younger. He's, I think, about 10 years old. And he has a misinterpretation for what an Irish goodbye is. And it's kind of a little sad and funny at the same time, but I really love the scene because I think it's a moment in time in the story where the sisters and the family, I would say, are starting to look forward rather than backward. And so I thought, you know, one, I love a great Irish goodbye. Two, it's about an Irish American family. And then three, I thought this scene was really, really pivotal for the story overall.
Now, do you have two sisters, or are you one of three sisters?
I am the youngest of three sisters.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it does seem like Maggie, you might be patterned after you in some ways. Is that true?
Yeah, it's not really.
Not really?
To be honest. I mean, I am the youngest and I am gay. But
that's where it stops.
It's funny how when I told my sisters that I was writing a book about three sisters, they were nervous.
I'm
not
sure.
Reason to be, but and then the joke is that when they started reading it, you know, they suddenly were like, wait a second, this is not about us. You didn't write about us? You know, so it went from them being nervous to then complaining that it wasn't about them. But I mean, all of the characters pull from the world that I come from. They pull from me, they pull from my sisters, they pull from my friends, from my wife. I know there's not a single character that is a particular person in my life or me, you know. It's all kind of a collection of the people that I know and love and are complicated and multidimensional and all the stuff, very human.
Now, at the heart of this story, there's the, you know, tragedy that befell the family. And is that a tragedy that you've had personal experience with?
No, there's really two tragedies.
In the family.
There is a, you know, I don't think I'm giving away too much to say that the book opens with a boating accident, and the sister's brother Topher is involved in that accident, and it's a bit of a mystery, like exactly what happened with the accident throughout much of the book. And the oldest sister, Kate, feels responsible for the accident, and that's a bit of a mystery too. What I wanted to explore in this family was the impact that this accident has on Topher, and then, you know, Topher's struggle to process that, and the shame that he endures as a result of that has, you know, the collateral damage is significant for him and for the family. I don't have experience with that specifically, but I did start the book wanting to write about grief. And I do have a lot of experience with grief. And so does my family. When I started writing about September 11th, which is something that my family did experience. We lost a lot of people on in the terrorist attack. As I was writing that story, and it wasn't the story of my family, but it was about that experience, it just felt too personal, and it was not a place I really wanted to spend a lot of time in. So I shifted gears and, you know, decided that I was going to focus on another tragedy.
Wow. So you had family members who were in the towers?
Yeah, my father's company was on the 104th floor of the South Tower, and he wasn't there, but his company lost 66 employees, including a lot of my friends, a lot of my sister's friends, our cousin Peter, obviously a lot of, you know, people my father loved dearly. So it was, yeah, it was a really tragic day for us. And that experience, you know, through that experience, I got to witness the impact of grief on so many different levels, on the level of community, on the level of family, and on the level of the individual. And, you know, grief can be really insidious. And I always knew that was something I wanted to write about. I just didn't know exactly how, you know, what the story was. And so when I did realize what the story was going to be for the Ryan family, a lot of things began to click for me there, because I kind of found a way in.
Do you think that you'll ever go back to writing more directly about 9/11?
That's such a great question. No one has asked me that. And I don't know. You know, I for me, you know, it's interesting. One of the scenes in the book with Maggie, the youngest sister, she's thinking about how her brother died. Her brother died, he died by suicide, and she's noting how people say things about suicide, you know, just kind of randomly. And, you know, for example, somebody might say, you know, I'd rather shoot myself than do that. Or, you know, people say things like that. And I know that is really hard for people who have lost people to suicide. And I've definitely had that experience with people talking about the events of September 11th, where someone may not know, you know, my personal connection to it, and will explain something about the day that they were there, and will provide a detail that will just, yeah, I absolutely feel like a kick in the gut. And when you have an experience like that, which is you know, it was felt on a national level. Like, everybody kind of has, you know, anybody who was alive to remember it has that moment of, this is where I was when that happened.
Yeah.
And so I my feeling is that, you know, because I can barely stand those conversations, I can't imagine really, really writing something of. But I don't know, you know,
yeah.
I mean, we change a lot, and and a lot of what this book was about was kind of the process of grief and moving forward, and really, and it did make me think about my own experience with September 11th and kind of where are the places that I'm stuck. So I don't know, maybe.
Now, I understand that this book has another connection to September 11th, 2024.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So one of the kind of wild things about it is that I began writing about September 11th and switched and then, you know, just decided that I was going to explore another element of loss in the Ryan family. But when my book was acquired, I found out on September 11th, 2024.
Wow.
Which was just pretty wild. You know, I mean, I do believe that, you know, that we get messages from beyond, and that felt like a message to me.
Wow.
Big time. Yeah, it's pretty wild.
Yeah. So, Heather, why don't you read a little bit from The Irish
Sure.
Goodbye?
Yeah. I'm going to read the opening pages, which, again, I mentioned earlier, the book begins with Maggie as a child in the 90s on the beach, and she experiences the tragedy that's going to then impact her brother. But I'll just read the first couple of pages. August 1990. Like everyone at the beach club that day, Maggie heard the crash. She jumped up from the sandcastle she was building and spotted her brother Topher diving off the bow of his skiff and disappearing into the blue-black water along the lighthouse's rocky promontory. A moment later, he resurfaced, holding something she couldn't make out from the shore. Alice, Maggie's middle sister, scrambled to the top of the rickety lifeguard stand and shouted down to Maggie, "Get Mom." Maggie hesitated. She wanted to see what was happening with her brother. Plus, she felt confident about her chances of winning the Port Haven Beach Club sandcastle competition. But when Alice shouted again, Maggie took off down the beach toward her family's house. She liked all the eyes on her as she ran, fists curled and arms pumping. From the dock, someone yelled, "Call 911. At the jetty that cut across the shoreline in front of her family, she scrambled over the rocks covered in slippery seaweed, slicing the inside of her ankle against a jagged edge. It stung, but she didn't stop. She hurried up the creaky stairs along the bluff and through the fence gate, calling for her mother. The geese fluttered their wings and scattered, frightened by her screams. She sprinted across the slope of lawn, wet from the sprinklers, and toward the white and blue Clapper Victorian, which suddenly seemed massive and terrifyingly empty. She called out again, and to her relief, her mother appeared from the garden, holding a paintbrush in her teeth and wearing her floppy straw sun hat. Her easel was set up by the lavender blooms she'd been painting all week, and splashes of red and blue covered her smock. She tucked her paintbrush behind her ear. "What's this about?" she asked. "Something happened," Maggie said breathlessly. Her lungs burned from the running. Her mother lowered herself to inspect the blood on Maggie's ankle. "Did you fall?" Maggie shook her head and pointed to the bay. "Is someone hurt?" her mother asked, standing. Maggie wasn't sure. She'd heard the crash and then seen Topher dive into the water. Her oldest sister, Kate, was supposed to be on her brother's boat, but she hadn't seen her there. The boat. Topher jumped in. She grabbed her mother's hand. "Just come."
And that's the opening of The Irish Goodbye. So, how far did you get into the original version of this book before you changed it? And what were there parts that you could still use?
Yeah, that's a good question. From what I remember, I was probably 6 months and 50 pages in, 50 or so pages in to the book. And I knew it was going to be this character of Topher, whose death was going to kind of rattle the family. I knew it was going to be a story about sisters, and I was curious how the sisters' lives, the dynamic, amongst the siblings would change at the loss of their brother. So all of that was in place. And there was actually a fourth sister, but I took her out because she just was, it was a lot of voices. Yeah. So I decided to take her out and just focus on the three. And I had certain things down that stayed the same. The setting of Long Island, at a big old Victorian house on the water. I knew that was going to be where the story would take place. I knew it would be an Irish American family. I wanted to explore topics of religion, Catholicism, the impact that has on the character who's the mother, Nora. So those were all in place. And I was curious how this event, and again, it started with September 11th, how this event and the grief that emerges from this event shapes all of the characters. And then around the time that I just began to feel, I think it's important when you're writing a story, you like want to spend time in the world of the story. And when I was feeling that I didn't want to spend time in the world of September 11th, it was just too painful. I could see that there was some resistance to returning to the page, and obviously that's not good.
It's going to be hard to finish a book that you don't want to write.
You know, it's hard enough.
Right.
And then I was at an event with my wife for the Jed Foundation, which is this incredible organization that provides resources to college campuses for suicide prevention. And I know people who've died by suicide. And I was just so moved by the stories of the people there that that was a moment it clicked for me. This is what I want to write about. And I felt like this was something that was very meaningful to me, but also something that I could show up for and show up fully. And so I could take a lot from the original and move it into this new storyline.
So let's talk a little bit about Nora, the mother.
Sure.
So she is not a point of view character, mm-hmm. but she's very, very important character.
Sure.
And she was an orphan in Ireland. And how does, why did you choose to have her be an orphan, and how does that impact her as a character throughout the story?
I for a couple of reasons. One, because I know people who've actually had that experience, and I was curious about it and wanted to explore it more. Two, as I said earlier, I wanted to explore the impact of faith on the family, and she felt like a good character to even though she wasn't a point of view character, I was curious how faith had shaped her and how it helped her throughout her entire life. I think that faith for Nora was the thing that helped her survive her difficult childhood. But now it is, the rigidity that she has around her faith is preventing her from fully accepting her youngest daughter. And I wanted to see whether there was an opportunity for growth there. And I also, one of the other reasons that I wanted Nora to be an orphan was one of the themes in the book is, all of the characters are kind of stuck in this past, and each of them are stuck in their own past for their own reasons. And there's a lot of things that happen over the course of the weekend that I hope is helping to get them unstuck. And for Nora, I think she is stuck in this place of having to take care of herself, relying on her faith, this idea that she wanted to have a big family, but now this big family that she has is kind of falling apart, in part because of her struggle to be present for all of the daughters and for herself. And that felt like a good backstory to help understand what was limiting her in the present. That was like a real question for me for all of the characters, or at least, all of the point of view characters and Nora, who kind of get the most stage time in the book, is not just like, okay, this thing happened in the past and now their lives are a bit of a mess. It was like, how is it showing up very specifically in this moment for each of them? And how are they kind of colliding into each other as a result?
Right, right. Well, why don't you run down through the three sisters and sort of summarize who they are?
Sure. The oldest is Kate, and she is a lawyer, a single mother with twins who lives in London after her brother died. And as I mentioned, she feels partially responsible for that. She kind of took off. She got married to her husband's from Amsterdam. They got married and she has lived in the UK for the past decade. And she's returning home after she's been away for 5 years. She's recently divorced. And She, again, you know, she's going to be inviting someone from their past to the dinner. That's going to create a lot of conflict. And, you know, to me, she was an interesting character to write because she's a lot of fun. You know, she's a bit of a, you know, she's the character that anytime she came into a room, I know something was going to happen. And, you know, something was, but she was interesting because I think she calls everybody else out, but she's so terrified of being called out herself, you know, because she's holding the secret and it's created so much self-blame and shame. And I see her veneer is just this, you know, it's just a desire to protect herself from anybody, like really seeing who she is. And then there's Alice, who is the middle sister, and she has quite a grudge against Kate because Kate left shortly after their brother died. And Alice feels that it was really her responsibility to take care of their parents, who were deep in grief. And, you know, she's very much a caretaker, and she has been for her family of origin, now for her husband, Kyle, and for her two sons. But she's at a point in her own life where she wants to be doing something different and doing something for herself. And she's restarted her career as a designer, and that's very fulfilling for her. But something is going to happen over the course of this weekend that jeopardizes that new liberty. And it's going to put her in direct conflict with Kyle and really with herself. So that's Alice's character. Maggie is the youngest. She teaches at an elite boarding school in Vermont. She's gay. She's bringing her girlfriend Isabel home for the first time. And as I mentioned, her mother is deeply Catholic and not, I don't want to say doesn't support Maggie, but just doesn't really understand Maggie.
Not real accepting.
Yeah, she's not. And I really didn't want to villainize Nora for that. I mean, I could, but I was more curious about it. You know, why does she have this barrier? And so, you know, what a lot of what Maggie is struggling with is bringing Isabel home, and, you know, making this introduction and really being comfortable with herself. But in the meantime, she also has had a recent indiscretion with an ex-girlfriend, and that is kind of coming back to haunt her over the course of this weekend as well. So they're all, you know, they're colliding into each other and into their past selves, and they have a lot to figure out.
Yes. And then there's the father and the family priest and the
Father Kelly. Yeah.
And the kids, the next generation.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and it's fun reading, you know, some of the descriptions of the kids and they're playing together and grandpa trying to get rid of the raccoons that are bothering the garbage bin it sounds is did you grow up in an old Victorian home sort of out in the middle of nowhere?
I didn't grow up in an old Victorian home, but I did grow up on the water on Long Island, and that house is just it's in my bones. You know, I love. I live in Brooklyn, so I live in a small apartment, and have no desire to have a big home or to, you know, even have a home on the water as lovely as it is, because it's a lot to maintain. It's a lot to protect against the elements. And, but I have, you know, such a deep love and appreciation for that. I mean, my parents' home still feels like home to me when I go back there. So I was excited to set it in a place that I know very intimately and has really, you know, shaped me in so many ways.
And do they have geese?
Oh, they sure do. and raccoons.
And raccoons.
And deer. They have this summer. So my wife and I take our sons out for the month of July and stay with them every summer, which is lovely because the kids can go to camp there. And but this past summer, the deer started coming onto their property. So that was really lovely. Yeah.
Well, for people who don't know, geese can actually be pretty scary.
They can be
very aggressive. You really don't want to mess with the geese.
You don't, especially mama geese.
Yeah. And you don't want to mess with the raccoons either.
They
can be pretty vicious. One time when I lived out in the country, I had a dog, a Siberian Husky, and one night she was outside and there was a raccoon that she was fighting, and the raccoon lost, but it was,
they're aggressive.
They can be pretty big.
They can be. We see raccoons in Brooklyn. It's pretty wild. They are quite big. And but I had a cat in high school who did not win the fight with a raccoon and died.
Oh.
And yeah, it's we. My wife is a big fly fisher person, and so we fish a lot. We were on a river in Long Island, actually. And there was a raccoon that was kind of circling the area, and he kept trying to cross the river. More of like a stream, I would say. And, we would kind of yell at it and whatever. And he was so aggressive. So finally we just left because, it was daytime, and if they're coming at you in the daytime, you don't want to be anywhere near them.
Yeah, that's for sure. So you really don't shy away from kind of religious controversy a little bit in this mm-hmm. book.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you want to bring that element into this story?
I wanted to bring that element into the story because around the time that I started writing the book in 2019 and was writing it into the 2020s. And during that time, and certainly still now, my experience of watching all of the toxicity and divisiveness in this country on a political and cultural level was just so heartbreaking. It continues to be so heartbreaking. And
it's not getting any better, is it?
It's not getting any better. And I wanted to write about something that I found challenging, which was I know a lot of people who have experienced rejection from their family because they're gay and for religious reasons. And so I wanted to engage in a topic and a question and something that I know has caused a lot of pain for a lot of people that I love in a way that allowed nuance and wasn't just about, one person is right and one person is wrong and one person is bad and one person is good, but more of a, like, what is actually happening here and is there a way forward? So I didn't want that to be the entire book. It could be an entire book, certainly.
And I'm sure it has been.
And I'm sure, yes, without a doubt. So that was really where that came from. And I have people in my life. I grew up Catholic, but both of my grandparents were very religious, but very progressive. And so I had a different experience with that. And I know a lot of people who are religious and I'm talking particularly with Catholicism, and where this is not an issue, but again, I know a lot of people where it is an issue. And so I wanted the book to tackle difficult topics, and this isn't the only one that it tackles, but I wanted it to do so with nuance and empathy and compassion and not just a a tidy moral takeaway.
You hit the big three: divorce, abortion, and sexual orientation.
I wasn't, that wasn't quite intentional, but it did turn out that way.
And of course, you know, I also grew up Catholic in a large family, and I would say things have, from my perspective, things have improved a lot. That there isn't the that the rigidity is less. Now, there certainly are people and people that I know who still have very rigid views of these issues, based on their faith. But there's certainly, but there's a lot of room for dialogue now. I think that there wasn't when I was a child, that it was much more rigid. And I follow some priests on in Instagram or Twitter or wherever it is. Still call it Twitter when I look at it, which I try not to do. Yeah. But anyway, that I find very, you know, I really like their ideas and what they're saying. Father James Martin, I don't know if you're familiar with him.
I think I follow him too. Yeah, I follow a couple of them.
Yeah, and it makes me, even though I am no longer a practicing Catholic, but it makes me feel good to know that there are people like that out there who are moving the needle little by little by little. And our last two popes, you know, the current one and the prior one, I feel much more hopeful for the future of
Catholicism. I do too.
You know, because of that. So,
yeah, I do too. I have a mixed experience with the Catholic Church. There's a lot about it where I can feel comfort or familiarity in going into a church. But also rejection, and so I'm so grateful for the people out there that like you mentioned, have arms wide open, and I do hope for more dialogue. I mean, all around, more dialogue we need. I'm longing for that. I think a lot of people are longing for that. Not screaming at each other, not, shutting each other down, but just having real conversations.
Absolutely. So I also understand that you had a reading disorder, which, how did you overcome that to become a writer and teacher of writing?
Yeah, so speaking of Catholic school, I had to leave Catholic school in fourth grade because I just wasn't getting the services that I needed. I just really struggled to read. It's a reading disorder that is in my family, extended family, father. My youngest niece was just diagnosed with dyslexia. So I have cousins, My grandmother, who was the mother of seven children, my father's the oldest, she saw this in a lot of her kids. And so when it began to trickle down to the next generation, to the cousins, or to her grandchildren, she understood it. And so she really helped me learn how to read. But I definitely needed additional help, which is why I went to public school and finally was able to get those resources. And once that, once I was able to get the resources that I needed, it was fine. But that experience really shaped me from the perspective of, it gave me a lot of compassion for people who learn differently. People who are expected to follow like a particular kind of path and that doesn't quite, work for them. But I know a lot of writers who have dyslexia.
Really?
And yes, it is such an interesting thing. I feel like I want to write something about this because it's pretty interesting. But I think there is something to, like, when writing and reading doesn't come naturally to you, and it does kind of more or less to everyone around you, or at least at like a more natural progression, you have to work so hard for it. <laughs> You know? <laughs> Like, at least for me, it like became my focus. I mean, I remember not being able to read. I remember that experience of frustration. So, you know, just not really getting it, and then getting it, really being like, oh yeah, now I can do this thing. And it was so exciting. And so, you know, and my grandmother was also a writer, so I don't know, maybe there's something in,
so maybe
in the
because
blood.
You had to work harder for it, it meant more to you.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. It was really important to me. I was very curious about it. What is this thing that everybody can do? And you know, obviously I could feel the frustration from my teachers in Catholic school, and that certainly never felt good.
Yeah.
So I felt a lot of pressure and a lot of anxiety. And once that was removed, and I could, you know, and I was given again the tools and the resources, then the magic and the joy, you know, came to the surface.
Well, my son was dyslexic, and mm-hmm. you know, when he was, I remember bringing a paper home from probably kindergarten or first grade where I could read it if I held it up to a mirror. To him, it looked completely normal. You know, it was like he was completely reversing the letters in his mind, in his brain. And I asked to have him tested. And the problem was that when they tested his visual comprehension, he was at grade level. Now, if they tested him orally, he was 3 to 4 years ahead of grade level. So it mm-hmm. actually was slowing him down a lot.
Yeah,
but
sure.
Because he was still at grade level, they wouldn't give him any help, any additional help. It's like, well, that's good enough.
No. it's really interesting, the experience of watching my niece, who's now 12 years old, and she had to be taken out of the school that she was in because she wasn't getting the services that she needed, and put into a different school. And it was heartbreaking to watch some of the things that I experienced happen to her, you know, decades later. And I was like, God, really? Like, have we not learned? But you know, on the other side, to your point about, you know, our conversation about the Catholic Church, you can see the ways that things have gotten better, and that there's more opportunity for diagnosis and for help, and
she
and
has you as a role model.
Absolutely,
that's
totally
great.
And she's a great writer, actually. She's really interested in writing, so
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today has been Heather Amy O'Neill, author of The Irish Goodbye. Heather, we only have a few minutes left. Tell me a little bit about how you found your publisher.
So I found my publisher. The book is published through Henry Holt, and I met my agent, Serena, about 6 months or so before my book went out on submission, because we have a mutual friend, Jane, and I was in the process of querying agents, and Jane said, oh, you should meet with my friend Serena at Holt. You know, she mostly does nonfiction, but she knows a ton of agents, and she'd probably be able to point you in the right direction. And so we met and had a great conversation. And at the end of it, she said, you know, I don't really do a lot of fiction, but what is your book about? And I told her what it was about. And she also had sisters. And she said, that sounds really interesting. If you end up getting an agent, have them send it to me. You know, I'm curious, you know, you never know. And I didn't take that as anything but a polite, you know, send off.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then when I did get my agent, I mentioned that to her, and she said, great, we'll include it in the submission. And Serena was the one who won out. And I could not be happier, and you know, just more thrilled to be working with her and with Holt. And I just sold my second book to them, so that's really exciting.
Well,
and
congratulations.
We'll be working with them on that.
Wow. Have you already started writing it? Or
I have. I have 3 chapters and a pretty comprehensive outline. So something to work with, but still plenty of work ahead.
Can you give us any hint about what it's about?
Yeah, it's called Winter Island, and it is about a surrogacy, high stakes surrogacy, where the lives of the 3 people collide, and lots of drama.
Okay. Now, was it hard to find an agent?
So when, as I mentioned before, I have a lot of the writers that I work with, I have their agents, have their publishers, and so I, you know, it was somewhat of an uncomfortable position for me to be in, to suddenly the people that I was helping to ask them for help.
But I'm sure many of them wanted, were happy to give back. Yes.
They absolutely were. And I was really touched by that. And so, you know, it was a combination of recommendations, and I put together my own list. And Sharon, the agent that I ended up going with, was, you know, I had, at that point, I met with a couple of different agents, and she just felt like the right fit, and had a really strong vision for the story. And we got along, and I felt like she was the right one. I'm thrilled with that choice. But it's hard. I mean, finding an agent is a whole other, you know.
So at this point, how much of your time do you spend on your own writing versus your, editing work for others?
I would say it used to be 75% editing for other people and 25% writing, and now it is about 60% writing, 40% editing. So,
and do you do like both every day, or there's some days devoted to one, some days to other? And how do you decide what you're going to do today?
Well, when I was writing The Irish Goodbye, I was very, very busy teaching and editing. But the one non-negotiable for me was I always kept Thursday completely for my writing. And that was my day of writing. And then I would try to grab some hours on the weekends. But now I definitely am the kind of person that likes to have a nice chunk of time to write. So I'll take like the morning, early afternoon for writing, later afternoon for editing, or just a full day for writing, a full day for editing. My brain, that's the way my brain works. You know? Like it likes to zone in and stay there and get it done.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Heather. We are out of time. We always close with the quote, and I have one from an Irish headstone. Death leaves a heartache no one can heal. Love leaves a memory no one can steal.
Beautiful. Love that. Thank you for sharing it. And thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. And we will say goodbye. So this won't be an Irish goodbye.
Perfect.
Bye-bye. And see you all next week on Writer's Voices.